In the early days of television, there was a program that played out people's dreams of sudden wealth. A stranger knocked on a door, and the person who lived behind it was handed a check for $1 million from an anonymous philanthropist. The drama which played out from there always spun around the question of how the person handled that sudden windfall. Did they spend it wisely or squander it? Did they become a miser or give it all away? The possibilities were endless. You may think such a windfall will never come your way, but the World War II generation was careful with money. One study estimates that that generation will pass on between $12 and $18 trillion when they die. That means more people than ever may inherit money from their parents or grandparents. And many heirs are blindsided by a sudden windfall because money wasn't talked about at home. Maybe you're not expecting to inherit money, but there are other ways of getting a financial windfall, a lump sum retirement payout, an insurance or divorce settlement. Who knows? Maybe you'll win the lottery someday. What would you do with a sudden financial windfall? Quit your job? Change your lifestyle? Spend it? Invest it? Give it away? Are you prepared for the challenges and decisions that come with it? This hour, we'll talk about how to handle a windfall, both emotionally and financially, and where to go for help if you need it. Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Marla Brill joins us this hour from the studio of member station WBUR in Boston. She's the author of Windfall, Managing Unexpected Money So It Doesn't Manage You. She's also a financial journalist and founder of the website fundsinteractive.com. Welcome, Ms. Brill, to the program.
Good afternoon, Lynn.
First, let's put this in perspective. When we're talking about a windfall, what do we mean? Because that has to mean different things to different people. It could be $20,000 for one, a million for another.
Well, that's right. It's an amount that is significant to you. And for some people, that can be $10,000 or $20,000. And for others, it would have to be a sum of $1 million or more. So it's really a very individual thing. It depends how much money you have to begin with is one what your starting point is.
So what you do from there can be dependent on whether it's a big windfall or a rather smaller windfall.
Right. I mean, if you're talking about, let's say, $10,000 or $20,000, you might have options like paying off credit card debt. Whereas if you're looking at something in six figures or more, your options are obviously more open.
Well, what's the first thing someone should do when they find out that they are getting some money and money they really didn't know they were getting?
Well, it depends on the particular circumstances. For example, in an inheritance, it's often an unexpected situation because parents often don't talk about their financial resources with their children. So there's often not a lot of time to prepare for something like that. And there are some situations where if it's a long illness or something of that nature, then there is more time to prepare. If it's a sudden kind of situation where, you know, there's a sudden death in the family, then a lot of times the best thing to do is first find a good accountant and or attorney and minimize the impact of taxes, you know, take steps like that initially, and then later on worry about investing the money and making it grow.
You know, if you're not good with money and you're inexperienced with it, how can you tell whether you've got a good financial advisor or someone who might be taking advantage of you?
Well, there are a couple of signs of someone who might be taking advantage of you. If an advisor tends to recommend very heavily loaded products, by load I mean sales commissions, that are taken out of your investment, and that can be done in several ways. It can be done as a front-end sales charge, or it can be done in the case of a mutual fund, with a back-end sales charge, but there are any number of ways to do it. But if you find that a lot of the recommendations you're getting are for heavily commissioned products, that should send a red flag to you. Another thing that might send a red flag to you is if you're getting recommendations that you don't feel comfortable with. It's called the squirm factor. And if someone is recommending stocks or internet securities or things that just you don't feel right about and seems fairly insistent on it, or likes to do a lot of trading in the account, which is just not your style, that's another thing that you should watch out for. You want to find someone whose philosophy meshes with your own, who, if you say, well, I feel a little more comfortable in bonds, who doesn't try to steer you towards something else that might pay a higher commission.
Let's say that you get a windfall, which is enough money to last you a lifetime. You don't have to work again. Is it a mistake to quit your job?
It usually is a mistake because people underestimate the amount of money they need to last through a lifetime. If, you know, you're 40 years old, for example, you've got perhaps 20 more years in the working world or more. So that's a lot of income that you would need to replicate through a windfall. And even $1 million, when if there's a situation where taxes need to be taken out, it's a lot of money, and it can certainly relieve financial concerns such as college funding or give you a head start on retirement, certainly, and enhance your lifestyle. But it's not necessarily enough to let you quit work. So that's something that a lot of people underestimate their income needs and what it's going to take to last them through their lifetimes.
We're talking about unexpected financial windfalls and how to manage the money on Talk of the Nation. The number is 800-989-8255. Let's go to Peter in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hello, Peter.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Well, my parents were relatively well off, and my father did die about 8 years ago. But my mother, or my stepmother, Francoise, she and I had talked about this and met with an investment counselor who's here in Cambridge. So it was pretty clear if anything was left over, if it was a fortune or two quarters to rub together, we knew what we would do. And as it turned out, she had a stroke and died close to 2 years later in a nursing home. But still, in spite of that, because of her French pension and a lot of other things, there was a six-figure amount on hand, low to middle range six-figure sum. And my reaction is a terrible, uncomfortable mix of being one, who doesn't want to, you know, when you inherit something that's really quite wonderful in a way and that they prepared it for you, but also the terrible cost that it takes when this finally comes along. You lose your family. You lose your family.
Exactly.
And that has haunted me ever since. Although, what I did do was I kept my promise. I invested 90% of it with my investment counselor. That's where it sits at the moment. I made several gifts and then have just gone on with life basically fairly simply, and in the last 8 or 9 years had become much more frugal anyway, getting older because I'm in my 50s, and finally have come to at least some spiritual peace with this, working with a therapist once every couple of months who has I've been seeing since my father died, and just trying, one, to take care of yourself, that you know you're well off on the one hand, but that that absolutely does not guarantee you spiritual or emotional comfort necessarily at all. And in a it didn't for me for quite a while.
It sounds to me like what you're saying, Peter, is that for you it wasn't a problem. The problem wasn't managing the money. It was really managing your, not even managing, but dealing with the emotions you were feeling on your parents' death. And money was sort of a side to that.
Well, you almost feel like it was, I talked with my godson's mother, Sharon. I talked with all sorts of people. It was like you felt you were almost evil knowing this was coming and trying to sort it through. And it was only after talking with quite a few people that I finally felt really good about it. But I also realized that I had loved both of my parents without reservation. And as you gradually realize that, then you could live with this and realize this is a gift, but but for God's sakes, use it wisely, be intelligent, be thoughtful, and try to be generous with other people in doing so, but not leave yourself out on a limb.
Thanks so much for that call, Peter.
The pleasure's mine.
Great points, and I'd like, Marla, if you could just comment on the reaction that Peter had and how common that is.
Oh, it's very common. Inheritances are such a mixed bag of emotional responses that one has, and I think people are surprised when they inherit money and there's a sort of guilt about it that, gee, maybe mom should have spent the money more, or dad should, they should have gone traveling more. I feel a little bit guilty about getting this. And that's a very common reaction. And it might take a few weeks to get over, and it might take months or even years to get over. But it's certainly something that a lot of people experience, and they're surprised when they experience it, because the common notion that when you receive a lot of money, your problems are going to be solved is dispelled very quickly, and it's replaced by, gee, I wish there was some other way I could have gotten this, but, it's a very common thing.
All right. Let's go to Andrew in Washington, D.C. Hello, Andrew. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
Good. I just wanted to first thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a couple points. This is a great topic. I'm a financial advisor with a large insurance company in Washington. I just wanted to make two points. The first is I wanted to completely agree with the panelists concerning working with advisors, accountants, estate planners, and financial advisors, helping people cope with what to do with windfalls of money. I think it's crucial in helping people, you know, realize their goals and what their needs are and investment objectives. The one thing that I wanted to stress, though, and I think a lot of the panelists or people that we have speaking about money, is, I mean, being an advisor, I mean, I feel like I earn the commission that I make. And let's just talk about a normal mutual fund commission of, let's say, 5% loads. I mean, people go to restaurants twice, three times a week, and will actually tip somebody 15% of the amount of money they owe them for services that are just serving food. I think when you're truly working with an advisor, it's not about commission. You should look at, you know, referrals from other people that you know who have money. Obviously, interview advisors is very important, you know, looking at what their histories are, who they work with, and getting referrals from them. But I don't think when we talk about commission, that's really, is not a forefront for looking at who to work with and what your advisor is charging you. Because in the end, if your advisor is meeting your goals and needs and is putting you in a position to live that life that you're looking to live with a windfall of money, that's really what's important.
Okay, thanks for that call, Andrew.
Thank you.
Marla Brill, did you want to comment on that? Because you had suggested earlier that when somebody is looking for a financial advisor, that one thing they might look at is what kind of commission the person is looking for, and whether they're recommending things that would make a lot of money for them as opposed to necessarily for you.
Well, I wasn't meaning to suggest that commissions were the only criteria. And certainly financial advisors deserve to be paid like anybody else for their service, which is a very valuable one. What I was trying to suggest is there are unscrupulous people out there in the financial advisor community, just like there are in any other profession. And if it seems that there are a lot of recommendations, for example, some advisors would be better off recommending bonds versus bond funds, which are bonds are less expensive to buy. There's just no question about that. So there are certain things that you have to look out for, but by no means is commission the only criteria. You have to feel comfortable with your advisor.
Okay, thanks, Marla Brill. We're talking about what to do when you come into money. What do you want to know about managing a windfall? We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about managing a large sum of unexpected money. Our guest today is Marla Brill. She's the author of Windfall, Managing Unexpected Wealth So It Doesn't Manage You. You're invited to join the discussion. Did you ever receive an unexpected large sum of money? And what's the first thing you did? Or did you give advice for other people who receive windfalls? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. That would be org. And joining us now are Eileen and John Gallo. Eileen is a therapist specializing in emotional issues related to money, and John is an estate planner. They formed the Gallo Institute to help people deal with their wealth, and they've got a book called Silver Spoon Kids, How Successful Parents Raise Responsible Children. The Gallos join us from our Los Angeles Bureau. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Hi, Lynn.
Eileen, I don't know if you were listening in, but we had a call earlier from a gentleman who was talking about the emotional issues he had to deal with when he inherited money, and the fact that he recognized that with that came this terrible loss of his family. Generally speaking, how would you say people do react to a sudden windfall, particularly inheritance? Is it a positive or negative experience?
I think there's a range of emotions that are really unique to the individual. Peter, I think the gentleman was, he was able to kind of reframe his experience and to eventually see it as a gift after he was able to move through some of the grief process. But I think people have a full range of different emotions.
Now, you've identified, or there have been identified, and I think you've worked with this frame of reference, of money personalities. Can you explain what money personalities are and the different types there might be?
Well, I was doing my dissertation study on the psychological impact of sudden wealth from 95 to 97, and I did a complete literature review in preparation for this, and most of the paradigms of money personalities, I experienced them as somewhat negative. There was sort of a tenor of negativity or pathology. People were sort of put in boxes and negative titles like hoarder or overspender. And what I did is I developed a new paradigm of looking at money personalities. And I see people's relationship to money in three different dimensions: how they use it, how they acquire it, and how they manage it. And I see each dimension on a continuum so that people are able to place themselves, describe their money personalities, and place themselves on a continuum that's mostly sort of, it's kind of fluid in a benign way of looking at how people relate to money.
When Eileen and I give our seminars and workshops in this area, we talk about the continuum as if it's a 12-inch ruler. And we suggest that really only at the very ends do you actually have pathological types of behavior, the true misers, the true spendthrifts. But probably the center 10 inches is just a very broad range of normal behavior. Some people are more towards frugality, let's say, and some people are more towards spending when it comes to the use of money. But you don't have to put them in a box.
The intersection of values and money is very interesting, and I think that's sort of what you're talking about and probably colors the way people would respond to inheriting a large amount of money or winning a large amount of money, that there is a value component to this. Eileen?
Very definitely. I think much of it goes back to the family of origin and what were the money messages that people received as children, whether they direct messages about money or indirect. How did parents use money? How did they acquire it? How did the parents manage the money in the family? And did they talk to the children about money?
We're discussing today dealing with a sudden windfall of money here on Talk of the Nation at 800-989-8255. And I'd like to take a call now. Judy in Portland, Oregon is on the line. Judy?
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
I have a question that's probably more for your financial advisor.
Marla Brill.
Yes. My father's trust is being liquidated, and in about a month or two, I'm going to get a check for in the neighborhood of about $160,000. My question is, when I actually have that check in hand, do I just go to the bank? And I feel kind of foolish going up to the teller and saying, here, I want to deposit this. I mean, I don't even know, like, step one of how to get this into an account. I understand that a lot of bank accounts are limited by the amount of insurance you can, you know, the $100,000 insurance. So I'm wondering, just step one, where do I park the money while I make some other decisions?
Marla Brill?
Well, the banks are used to handling large amounts of money. I know it's something that's very foreign to you, but it's something that, at least in larger cities, they're probably familiar with. You could do something as simple as deposit it in a money market account, a mutual fund money market account, and then make a decision from there. You just simply send the check there, or you would send it certified mail, or, you know, with some type of protection. But it's a check like anything else. Mm-hmm. So that's the way you handle it, only on a larger scale. And then as far as the longer term aspects of it goes, if you don't feel comfortable investing it yourself, you might want to go to a financial advisor. But just park it somewhere safe, like a bank or a money market fund, just for the time being, until you can sort of get your act together as far as how you want to invest the money, what you want to do with it, and until you feel a little more comfortable in your shoes about handling it.
Okay.
Now, can you tell me, money markets generally are not insured, is that right?
They're not insured, but historically, I don't believe that anyone has lost money in a money market fund. There was a case a couple of years ago where one of the money market funds had some junk paper in it, but the mutual fund company behind it eventually restored the value of it, so I don't believe anyone lost money. They're a very safe investment.
Okay.
So you think just the bank's money market would be the best place to start?
Right, or a bank or a mutual fund money market.
Okay.
Either of those.
Thanks so much for your call, Judy.
Thank you.
I'm just wondering, John and Eileen, maybe John perhaps, is this fairly typical what we're hearing, this kind of situation where Judy really is just saying, where do I even put the money in? Where do I put the check? I don't know what to even do with the check, much less invest it.
Oh, I think it's very common. People quite frequently have no training at all in money management. In fact, that's one of the reasons behind our writing our book on children and money, trying to get people to talk about money and let the children start experiencing money management. You know, if I had the check for $160,000, I'd probably go to two different financial institutions, put $80,000 in each because that's insured for my $100,000 amount, and then I'd be able to sit back and I'd wait a few weeks or maybe even a few months and start interviewing financial advisors to get an idea of how I should be investing that money. I wouldn't make immediate decisions.
We're talking about dealing with an unexpected windfall and whether or not you feel you're prepared to handle it. Wondering if anybody out there has had a bad experience, really didn't know exactly what to do when some unexpected money came their way and had a bad experience. Those of you who have had good experiences are also welcome to call at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And let's go to Sharon in North Carolina. Hello, Sharon.
Hi. Thanks very much. My question, first of all, just got answered. The first one, where do I put the check? The second, could one of your people explain living trusts to me? I envision an insurance settlement, if not a lawsuit settlement, coming down the way in the next several years. And I wanted to know, in my mind, I see putting it someplace where somebody else manages it. The bills get sent there even for them to get paid. I get some kind of an allowance for our month-to-month expenses, and that's how I see it playing out. Well, one of the women mentioned earlier talking about how much was needed for a lifetime And I don't even know how much you need to last a lifetime. I know I do need to read the book like Windfall, so I know how to manage things. But if you could just, like, explain the living trust part, and I'll take the answer off the air.
All right, John Gallo, I think you do estate planning.
Sure.
Can you take that?
A living trust is a trust that you create during your lifetime. It's revocable. You can change it. You can alter it. You can amend it at any time. Think of it like forming your own corporation where you own all of the stock and you're the president of the corporation. Usually, you're your own trustee. You put the property or the money in your name as trustee of the trust. And the great advantage of this arrangement is that the trust is immortal. You can get sick. You can pass away. But the trust can't. So you have an entity that can provide management of your assets. And the lady who just called probably would want to go off and hire a money manager to manage the funds that are in her living trust or in her revocable trust and arrange for a budget for her and arrange to pay her bills and send her her monthly stipend.
You know, I just want to bring up something that is a little bit different, but I think it fits into this whole subject, and that is inheritances in this country in particular right now can be eaten away by medical costs before a parent dies. And that those kinds of things can actually be dealt with through estate planning as well. Isn't that right, John? I mean, I'm just wondering about the process that takes place prior to the moment when somebody gets an inheritance.
Well, one of the most important things when you're talking about medical bills is to get good medical insurance, because lots of estates have been just totally destroyed by costs of hospitalization. There's also some situations that occur when you are just have a marginal amount of wealth that's just enough to disqualify you from getting medical Medicare. And in those situations, there are estate planners. Usually they specialize in elder law, and they are available to help people figure out how they can really spend down their net worth in order to qualify for Medicare.
Medicaid, I think you're talking about.
Yes.
Okay, let's take another call. Gordon in Asheboro, North Carolina. Hi, Gordon.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Twice I've come into money through, once through inheritance and once through gift, and it almost didn't seem like real money. And while I had it, it was almost like I felt, you know, guilty for having it. Now it's, and both times I ended up back to zero, not necessarily through risky investment, but, you know, put the money into houses or property or that sort of thing. But the directions I took, it just didn't seem like I'd earned it, so it didn't seem to have the value, although I appreciated where it came from.
Gordon, and I'm just curious. Can you tell us how much money you're talking about?
The first time was $125,000. The next time was $225,000.
And how long did it take you to go through that money?
Well, like they say with in contracting, it's kind of like farming. I just keep farming until the lottery winds run out. It was about 3.5 years on the second one in, you know, into construction trades and using it. But it almost seemed like I was, during that time period, I had a different sense of generosity or trying to do more for other people, as if I almost felt bad for having the money.
Wow. Eileen Gallo, I'd like you to take that question, if you could.
Yes. I wonder what kind of a financial education you had early on about money.
Microscopic. It wasn't something we talked about in our house. And,
right.
You know, if dad loaned you $20, you never asked for it back, so, you know, you never thought of a loan as being real in
hindsight. I think that's the answer. Is look back at your childhood and how did your family deal with money, and what kind of financial education was provided. I think that has a lot to do with how people grow up and relate to money later on in life, whether it's a gift, or it's earned wealth, or inheritance.
And what can I do to educate my children? How can we bring money into the family picture in a really healthy way to help educate them so they don't go down the same path as I? It's almost like I'm even afraid to make money now because I don't keep it. I mean, what's the point of putting it in because you're not going to get to hang on to it?
Gordon, I'm going to ask you to take the answer to this off the line. And I just want to ID my guest, Eileen Gallo. She's a therapist specializing in psychological and emotional issues related to money, children, and family wealth. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Eileen Gallo, if you can respond to that call.
Yes, John and I have written a book called Silver Spoon Kids that we wish we'd had when we were raising our three children who are now adults. And we really feel that money should be talked about, that kids should be educated, and we give almost it's like a handbook on how to talk to your children about money and relating it to your value system.
I'm just curious, did your kids run into trouble with money? You said you wished you'd had it when you were raising your kids.
Sure did.
Uh-huh.
They did. And in fact, our youngest son wrote the foreword to the book.
What happened?
He had run into some difficulty managing his money, and another one of our children too.
Hmm.
So how we handled it was, the logical consequences. They had to work their way out of it.
What is the worst thing that parents do? Is it not talking about it at all, or is it giving kids too much money, giving them an unrealistic idea of how much money they have? What's the biggest problem?
I think the biggest problem is not talking about it and not educating them.
And probably the second biggest problem is that when they do talk about it, they don't link their money values to their money behavior. Real simple example, a lot of times you're going to find parents saying, oh, we can't afford that, when the child asks for something. Really, the family can afford it. And what they really ought to be saying is, we don't think that buying you a $300 pair of aviator sunglasses at age 12 is part of our family values, rather than coming out with, oh, we can't afford it.
So spell it out, you're saying.
Spell it out, key it to your values, talk to your kids about money, don't hide it. In a large number of families, the message about money is really one of, we don't talk about money in our family, and we don't talk about the fact that we don't talk about money in our family. See, you end up with parents who've never talked about money with their kids, who just can't understand why their kids get into money trouble.
Why are people afraid of talking to them about money with their kids?
Oh, money has symbolic value to people, and a lot of people are concerned that if they talk about money, they're going to have bad luck. The gods will take it away from them. Other people are concerned that if they talk about money, that something bad will happen to them, or that their children will grow up to be spoiled, or their children will grow up to be overindulged. What we really find is that if you are afraid to talk about money, you really don't own it. The money really isn't yours.
Well, we are not afraid to talk about money here today on Talk of the Nation. Mm-hmm. We are talking about how to deal with it if you have an unexpected windfall. Many baby boomers and Generation Xers are going to come into some amount of wealth. Are you prepared to handle it? You can continue this conversation online. Go to npr.org, click on the discussion section, and scroll to Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Contributors also include the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Raymond James, listening to investors since 1962, independent advice and financial planning through over 2,000 offices coast to coast. Information at raymondjames.com. Rockefeller Brothers Fund, providing support for NPR cultural programming through a Charles E. Culpepper Endowment Grant. And the Freedom Forum, creator of The Newseum, the first interactive museum of news located in Arlington, Virginia. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When you think of President's Day, you think Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, in other words, men. In America, the idea of a woman president, well, it's still an idea. I'm Lynn Neary. We'll talk with some of America's most powerful women about their position in America's power structure. Join us on the next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Tomorrow, is American foreign policy leaving our allies behind? Today, how to manage money. If you've come into an inheritance, won the lottery, or otherwise received a large chunk of money, you're going to need some help, and we have some guests who may be able to help you. Marla Brill is the author of Windfall, Managing Unexpected Wealth So It Doesn't Manage You. We also have as our guest today the husband and wife team of Eileen and John Gallo. Eileen is a therapist specializing in psychological and emotional issues related to money. John is an estate planner. We'd like you to join the conversation. You can call us at 800-989-TALK. We've heard from quite a few people who have inherited a couple of $100,000 or $100,000. We're wondering if there are any of you out there who may have inherited some money, but not quite that much, maybe 10, 15, 20, a smaller amount of $10,000, or $20,000, perhaps a smaller amount. And maybe even some of you got a windfall in a different kind of way, an insurance settlement or a contest of some kind. We'd love to hear from you, too, at 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Let's go to Julie in Seattle, Washington. Hello, Julie.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
I can. Go ahead.
Great. I just had two short comments. I think it's important, my family and us children recently all inherited a small amount of money when we lost a parent, and I learned that it's important to treat yourself and sort of to honor that inheritance. It can be a small extra $10 dinner or something larger, but to do some small celebration in honor of the money you receive to sort of mark the occasion, within reason, of course. And my other point is, I have several adult friends who've inherited money, and I think when you're planning for your own children and setting up inheritances, one thing that I've noticed is really important is make sure you allow for the same amount for all your children, that it's equal. The source of unequal inheritance can be great strife in families.
Did that happen in your family, Julie?
No, not at all. It was completely equal, and it was a wonderful celebration and gift in equal manner for all of us.
Okay, well, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
And I think Julie made an interesting observation or point when she said that perhaps you should use the money in some special way to honor the person.
One thing that I did, my mother passed away about 5 years ago, is I donated some money to the Metropolitan Opera. She was a big opera buff, and opera was never something that interested me, but it made me feel a little bit better about it, about receiving the inheritance, that, you know, this was a celebration of something that she would have liked to do.
And is that something you advise people to do?
It's up to the individual. I know it's something that being able to give a sum of money that I normally wouldn't have given to an organization that meant a lot to her really did help me along. For someone else, it might not. So I guess it just depends on, you know, what an individual thinks is best for them.
Okay. Chris in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hello. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Thank you. This is a huge issue for me. I am married into a family that's extremely wealthy and went from being making $18,000 a year as an assistant librarian to being independently financially secure through my husband. Now it's many years later, and we have two children who are growing up, and a big, big issue for us is how to talk to them about money. We want them to stay grounded. We want them to be concerned with important things in life, you know, friends and family and doing good work and liking who you are and those sorts of things. But we also have to deal with the reality that they also will inherit a lot of money, and they'll have to go through all the kinds of things that we've gone through. And then do they relate to their friends who, it's going to become clear as they get older, don't have the kind of resources that we have. These are all the kind of questions we've spent a lot of time dealing with, my husband and I.
Now, would you say that overall it's been then a positive or negative experience?
Well, clearly it's positive, because we're free from a lot of worries that people have. You know, we don't have to worry about paying bills. We know we can provide our children with a good education and a nice home and all those kinds of things. The danger, I think, is that you can lose your motivation to do good things in life, to whatever that may be for you, to work hard, to find a vocation, to give back to your community. It would be easy, I think, to just sort of become very lazy, not careful. If you have enough money not that you don't have to work, then how do you motivate yourself to work?
Now, did this cause problems in your own marriage, that kind of problem, that kind of issue?
It did in the beginning, because you know, I came from a very different place from my husband financially, and he had already gone through all of these battles that all of a sudden, you know, I had to decide, do I want to work or not? Do I want to go to graduate school or not? You know, what am I going to do now that I don't have to do anything? So it I wouldn't say it caused problems between us, but he had to sort of watch me go through something he'd already struggled with. And he ended up becoming a PhD and has a job at the university. So, you know, he had sort of fought that battle and won, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Eileen Gallo and John Gallo, maybe you could respond to Chris's call, because a lot of what she's asking about is how what values indeed she wants to convey to her children with regard to money. John?
Well, I think that the true key here is being able to articulate your own money values. In our book, before we have the parents talking to the children about money, we have them go through a process of articulating their own values, trying to figure out what happened as they were growing up, or with this caller, the fascinating experience of marrying into money, and finding out how did that affect the caller herself. What are their values, and what are the values that they want their children to have? Once you've clarified those values of your own, you can then start using money as an opportunity to talk to your kids. The most important thing that I believe that Eileen and I both want to share is that you want the children to grow up knowing that money is something that they have. Money is not them. They are not their money. It is simply one of their possessions, and like any possession or any tool, it can be used positively or negatively.
And I think there are so many people who have great wealth who have done wonderful things with their families. They're involved in philanthropy. They've been wonderful, positive role models for their children. We tend to hear often the negative stories about wealth. But there's very, very positive things that can happen. And I think that it really, the core of the family, the heart of the family, is the communication, the modeling. Kids learn by watching, by observing their parents, and how do they deal with their money.
Okay. Andrew in San Francisco, hello.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I had a situation where I got about $50,000 in a severance package from a job that a company shut down. And I guess I think in retrospect, I lost most of the money just making bad investment decisions. And I guess all I can say as a piece of advice to people who do come under some kind of windfall is if you're going to invest the money, talk to somebody that knows what they're doing, or find, you know, a financial advisor, because, you know, obviously this happened during the very volatile market, and I chose a lot of high-tech stocks, et cetera, but I think it's still something that, you know, when you're dealing with a huge or a large chunk of money, it's a good decision to talk to someone who knows what they're talking about.
Okay, thanks for that call, Andrew. And let me ask you, Marla Brill, just respond to that. This is something that's come up more than once in this discussion, the question of getting a financial advisor and how to find a good one. And also, Andrew just referred to the fact that we've come out of this very volatile stock market, and I'm wondering if it's almost safer for someone to just take a $50,000 and stick it in the bank and let it sit there for a while, maybe not earning very much.
Well, if I knew the answer to that, it would be a miracle. But, you know, nobody knows what the markets are going to do. And the best advice a financial advisor can give you, and certainly the mantra for investing, is diversify. If someone invested all their money in internet stocks, and at the time it might have seemed like a good idea, might have lost a large part of their inheritance or severance packets or whatever it is. So I guess diversification is the best protection here.
But certainly for somebody that is innocent in the ways of money, gets a $50,000 severance package, should they try and invest it on their own or not?
Well, I think it depends on how comfortable they feel doing that. Some people would have no problem investing the money on their own. They might not make the right decision, and that's the problem, is do you trust yourself? How much do you trust yourself? But a lot of people are very competent in terms of handling money and can do it on their own. Others maybe should look at, if even if they feel confident, look at their past money decisions and judge by that. You know, have they made good decisions? Do they know how to handle money and be honest with themselves? And if they come up with an answer that says, well, maybe I should get outside help, then they certainly should. Or there are people who know right off the bat and they say, I don't want to deal with this. This is someone else's profession. I'm going to hand it over to someone else to handle. So it just depends on what you feel comfortable with and taking an honest look at yourself and assessing how well you think you can handle this.
Well, thanks very much, Marla Brill, and thanks to all our guests today. Marla Brill is a financial journalist. Her new book is called Windfall, Managing Unexpected Money Before It Manages You. She joined us from member station WBUR in Boston. And Eileen and John Gallo joined us from our Los Angeles bureau. Eileen is a therapist, and she specializes in psychological issues related to money. John is an estate planner, and together they run the Gallo Institute, which helps people deal with large sums of money. Their book is Silver Spoon Kids, How Successful Parents Raise Responsible Children.